Can we ask everybody to come in and start the session? We welcome you to the opening plenary session of the Washington Sunstone Symposium. I'm Bonner Ritchie. I'm on the board of Sunstone and just kind of a wanderer. Enjoy being places and I've spent a long time with Omar and didn't feel anybody else was really qualified to introduce him, so I needed to come back and straighten out the record. Most of you know him, and most of you have an association with him and are familiar with him, and so you don't need the traditional introduction. But we are happy to be here and welcome each of you. The Sunstone community is a fun opportunity. We struggle sometimes deciding who's in and who's out, and I have no need to make the decision. Some others do, especially in hierarchical positions. But it's a place for people who like to think, not for people who think alike. That's in no way a condition, but people who like to think. And a few years ago, someone commented on us, those who profess to be an alternative voice in the church. And my response was, it's not an alternative voice, it's an honest voice. It's an attempt to be honest and to be reflective and to share feelings and to share values and to engage in a dialogue and not to impose and not to demand a party line and not to demand any sort of litmus test of legitimacy. But rather to explore and have fun and share tears and dreams and frustrations and maybe be enlightened. All those things should happen tonight. I first met Omar in the mid-70s when we got involved in a high council together, which was kind of an interesting experience. In a political process, a campaign that was kind of interesting, and in some teaching that was very interesting. Omar and I team taught classes in business and society, and we had students walk out of class from time to time. Omar always claimed that they walked out on me, but there's a better part of that story. But it was fun, and I learned to appreciate a really thoughtful philosopher and a really creative teacher and a really honest, fun, sensitive person. I was a little disillusioned when Omar became a capitalist, and I'm still having a little hard time working through that particular role. It's one I never would have predicted 20, 30 years ago. But he did found and is CEO of Paltech, which is a very successful and exciting organization making a difference in the world. But he's moved from being a kind of philosopher and reflective teacher to an advocate and activist and a capitalist and a humanitarian. And those are all good strategies. My favorite description of him, though, is that he's a peripatetic curmudgeon. He just wanders the world making comments on any and everything that, that happens to come up. And they're always fun comments, interesting comments, stimulating, and his reflections on the Middle East are always new and different. You know, we were together a couple of weeks ago on a program, and tonight I know he's going to change his whole story and probably will come out to be a conservative Republican. But with that, all of you know Omar, I'm sure, and delighted to have him here. And so he will speak, we'll have questions, and then a reception following. Before Omar does speak, though, Kurt Linford will offer an invocation.
Oh, Our Father in heaven, we are gathered this evening as a community of friends, friends with many common interests and friends who are seeking greater understanding and camaraderie one with another. We are grateful this evening that we have an opportunity to meet and exchange views and thoughts and feelings, that we live in this free country that allows us thus. Father, we are grateful that Dr. Cater will be able to address us this evening and be able to expand our knowledge and understanding of the serious issues of the Middle East. And we ask that our minds might be opened and we might have a greater balance and understanding of the things that he presents. Bless us that as we participate in this symposium, that we might be able to have respect one for another in terms of our opinions and our thoughts, and that we might gain the greater understanding that we seek. And these blessings we pray for in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you. It's so nice to see so many friends and so many people that would show up for talk about a different side of the Mormon Church. Bonner taught me a lot in life, and one of them was to deal with ambiguity and remain cheerful. When you live in an absolute world that I grew up in, which was a deeply religious, superstitious Muslim family, deeply superstitious, and driven by shame. The whole idea in the Muslim family was that you don't shame the family, you don't shame the name, the tribe, you keep everything above board. And I, having been born and raised in Provo with shame, then I joined the Mormon Church and you throw on guilt. So it's really easy for you to shame or make me feel guilty. But I've done a lot of changing lately, so Bonner taught me how to deal with that in an ambiguous fashion, and he also taught me to abstract a little bit, to take things a little easier. And so when I ran up against the black and whites that I couldn't handle, he would kind of walk me through it, show me a shelf I could put it on. And that led me right out of the church. Not really. It led me right out of traps, because after I was on the High Council with Bonner, I was a bishop for a few years, and that was probably the most maturing experience I'd ever had. And a good one, and I'm grateful for that experience. I come before you not as a cheerleading Mormon, but as a Mormon who, if I had a bumper sticker like every one of you, it would say, "Leave me alone." And that's just, I have asked in nearly every group I've ever talked to, what's the one thing that every American could put on their bumper? And I have never found anybody that hasn't agreed with the idea that you could put "Leave me alone" on your bumper in America, and it would live well. In other countries, I hear different things. I found this piece out of an Israeli scholar's book, and it's the standard joke. Every speaker has to start with something funny, and this one is really good. Avi Shlaim is an Israeli scholar teaching at Oxford, and he's got a book called The History of the Arab-Israeli Conflict and a couple of others. He's a good writer. He says it's an apocryphal story told by Pope John Paul once, where he declared that there were two possible solutions to the Arab-Israeli conflict, the realistic and the miraculous. The realistic would involve divine intervention. And the miraculous would involve voluntary agreement. There's a lot to be said about the Arab-Israeli conflict. In San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, I talked about American foreign policy and what the great threats to American foreign policy are. To me, the great threat to America today is not the trade wars that we predicted 4, 5, 6, 8 years ago, but right after December of 1989, Berlin Wall fell, they opened it up, and we began to ask ourselves, what kind of a world are we going to face? And all the guesses and all the theorists came together. Well, most of us were throwing away our libraries, Cold War literature. And most of those books are useless for working through the relationships that we're going to have in the future. And there is a whole set of books that were written from 1989 to about 3 or 4 years ago about where America has to go and what we have to do to protect our national interests. And all of them are about globalization and trade. And then 9/11 hits. And the new fear in the world isn't globalization. The new fear in the world is Islamism. And Islamism isn't Islam or Muslims. It's the politicized radical Islamic movements of the world that aren't just against the West, but are philosophically opposed to our very existence and the way we live. They believe that the West was corrupted back in the 13th, 14th, 15th century in the onset of the Enlightenment, when suddenly secularism came into being. And they go back even further and say, we took out a scripture out of the Bible that just absolutely turned us into schizophrenic human beings. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar, the beginning of secular thought. And when you take that scripture, and there's no corollary to that in the Quran, and you say, what I'd like you folks to do every day of the week is I would like you to go to work, and I would like you to be secular, rational thinkers. And then on your Sabbath, what I'd like you to do is to be very faithful, and I'd like you to be spiritual, and I'd like you not to rely on reason, but I'd like you to exercise some degree of, and something about feelings. And that turned us into a secularized, schizophrenic world, and we destroyed humanity. That's the accusation from Osama bin Laden's intellectual philosopher, a guy named Sayyid Qutb. Qutb was a guy who absolutely discovered America after 2 years in Fort Collins, Colorado, at a teacher's college in the 1950s. He went to a church dance, and he saw people dancing together, and the minister playing the jukebox or whatever and dancing with everybody. He said, this is the corruption of the world, is when you can get people mixing and the sexes and everything's through this mixing and the role of women. At the end of the day, Osama bin Laden and all the Islamists have adopted Sayyid Qutb as their great philosopher. And if you want a good book about that, a guy by the name of Paul Berman has recently written a book called Terror and Liberalism. About a month ago, he wrote in the New York Times Magazine a piece on it and has the cover story about this fellow, Sayyid Qutb. And essentially what they've got is this philosophical difference with us on how we live our secular lives and where we're going with it. And they've got to stop us because we're out to destroy the world by taking religion out of society. Some of their best buddies intellectually live in the White House today with the faith-based initiative, trying to mix religion and state, trying to cast off more of government's responsibilities to churches, trying to get increased tax deductions and more tax dollars going back to churches, and trying to close the gap. Santorum of Pennsylvania, senator, for example, is one of those. He believes that John F. Kennedy was probably the devil of that, and there, in some recent editorials, including this last week, there's a talk about the people in this country who would like to bring church and state closer together. Tonight, I want to take it a step further. The Islamists are after us because they think that we're corrupting global civilization with secularism. Those are our enemies. Excuse me. What I want to talk about tonight is a bump in the road on the way to that fight, because I think the fight that we're taking on with the Islamists is as serious as any fight America has ever faced, and I think it's more serious than fighting communism. Because in the long run, if we are unsuccessful in taking on Islamists the way they need to be taken on and defeated, it will be a greater challenge to our national security than we will ever have faced, thank you, than we will have ever faced during the anti-communist times. The Arab-Israeli conflict is the darling of this cause. It's within our reach and within our scope to take it off the agenda. Everything that needs to be settled in the Arab-Israeli conflict is settled. There is no mystery about it. And the reason I want to talk about that tonight is there is an assumption in the church that the Arab-Israeli conflict can never be settled. In my dealings with the church, whether they're in my ward, stake, or I've dealt with general authorities in Salt Lake, they are absolutely convinced, and I've seen none admit, that it's possible to bring about a settlement to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And the reason they believe it can't be done is because it's complicated, extraordinarily complicated. but it's not more complicated than a management union labor contract. When American Airlines can sit down with its machinist, its flight attendants, its pilots, its cleaning operations, all of it, you're dealing with 9, 10, 11 organizations and unions, more, and you have to sit down and work out wages and increases. It's complex, it's difficult, it just takes clear-headedness. When you got lawyers involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict at the end of the Clinton administration, they were able all the strands of differences between the Arabs and the Israelis, right down to hilltop by hilltop, right down to not square blocks in Jerusalem, but square feet in Jerusalem, on how they're going to divide Jerusalem. It's done, it's written, it's agreed to by a certain group of Arabs, Palestinians, Muslims, Christians, Armenians, and some Jews, some Israelis. There are two groups that are violently opposed to a settlement in the Arab-Israeli conflict. One are the anti-American, anti-Western Islamicist Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and another group of Israeli, deeply politically religious Jewish advocates in the Likud. And I consider the Likud regime of Israel that we're dealing with the boogeyman of this problem. This is a fascist party. This is not labor and the mainstream Israelis. This is just Likud. And on the Islamic side and on the Arab side and on the Palestinian side, I think that Hezbollah and Hamas have dominated the agenda and completely destroyed Arafat in the process. And he has become marginalized because he's been unable to stem the suicide bombers. But let me take you through a 30-40 minute, as quickly as I can, history of this and bring you to the conclusion that it's solvable, not because I have faith that it's solvable. It's solvable because the paperwork and the documents are available online, where the Clinton administration, on the last day in office in the early wee hour mornings of January 20th, 2001, when the Bush administration took over, got signatures on nearly every outstanding issue between the Arabs and the Israelis, and they signed off on it. If you look up on the internet, it's called Taba Talks, T-A-B-A Talks. I've got copies of it, and I'll make more copies of it and bring them around tomorrow. And Taba Talks are an easy way to go through it. It doesn't help those of you who believe that the Arab-Israeli conflict can never be solved and that it's 1,000 years old, because it's not. It's about 100 years old. Taba Talks goes through the territory, Jerusalem, refugees, and security. And it goes into detail, mountaintop by mountaintop, settlement by settlement, every street in Jerusalem and throughout the West Bank and Gaza, on how to divide the country and how to do a settlement. But before we start, let me just run you through the root causes of the conflict. The causes, why do they fight? The motives, what drives them? The Israelis. So you've got thousands of years of rich civilizational record and stories about the Jewish people. But nothing is as powerful to them, not even Moses wandering for 40 years in the desert or whatever else you want to talk about, as the Holocaust. The Holocaust drives the psyche of every Israeli. The national conscience is informed by details of the Nazi experience. And this horrifying era of history that the Jews experienced have led them to making the Holocaust, it's as central to the Israeli collective conscious and many American Jews as their very existence. It is central to everything they think. And that is, who do you trust? Nobody. For those that aren't out to get us are either indifferent or don't care if others are out to get us. And no matter what Israeli I talk to, it goes back to the Holocaust. Now, be Jewish for a moment. Ask, who do you trust after the Holocaust? How much faith do you have after the Holocaust? Who do you care about? And who cares about you? And how can you convince yourself? To the Palestinians, it's what they call the Nakba. The Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe. They designate one village as an example, and it's called the village of Deir Yassin, and it dominates every narrative. And every April 9th since 1948, the Palestinians talk about Deir Yassin when a group of Israeli soldiers in their militia came through town and said, we need a demonstration project to clear Palestinians out of Palestine. And they took 250 of the inhabitants, killed them, stuffed them in a well, took the ones that weren't killed and hauled them off. Now, the numbers are slightly inflated depending on who you talk to. We don't know whether it's 80 or 90 or 250, but it doesn't matter. It's turned into the national narrative, the national myth, that the Israelis in 1948, on the very tail end of the Holocaust, were sweeping through Arab villages and massacring people. Now, you've got these two narratives and they clash. Between November 1947 and September 1948, an estimated 720,000 Palestinians were displaced out of Palestine. And the story begins. Israel was created in 1948, May 14, 1948, and the story begins there. It's a subject that provokes hot debates over wars, rights, differences, interpretations, and its different political motives. The subject has thousands of books and articles, editorials, workshops, conferences, associations, lobbyists that are dedicated to a slant and a spin. The definition of who is at fault is as full of libraries as you'll ever find. Trees die in vain for print on this. I would dare say that 90% of the material written on the Arab-Israeli conflict is useless because it's so flawed. It is the most intellectually dishonest field in academic life today, on both sides. On the Arab side, it ranges from total fabrications, total distortions, all the way over to violent, virulent anti-Semitism. On the Israeli side, it goes from total fabrication all the way over to racism, where they talk about this, who these are peasants, nomads, they don't really have a right to this because they couldn't do anything with it. There are hidden agendas in every explanation. The topic is laden with layers and of nuance. By the nature of your questions, you will be revealed as which slant you take, most likely unknown to even you. It is so nuanced. I only recommend one or two fairly decent books. One book I do recommend is One Land, Two People by Deborah Gerner, but it's going out of print. You can get used copies at Amazon. She's Jewish. It's an excellent book. Another one is by Mark Tesler, The Arab-Israeli Conflict. He's also Jewish, but it's a reference book, about 600-700 pages. And then there are a number of other small books that you can get. But those are good sources, and their footnotes are full of good sources. Let me see if I can manage this. There, it gives me a better slant here at my notes. I know that some Jewish person fixed this mic, so keep going. keep in mind that I'm a Palestinian. I have a unique perspective because I was born in the United States. So when I speak for all of those Palestinian, Arab, Mormon, Muslim Democrats. And I think I speak rather authoritatively on behalf of all of them. As complex as the Arab-Israeli conflict is, it is not unsolvable. While it is complex, it is not beyond our human solution. Contrary to popular myth, the Arab-Israeli conflict between the Palestinians and the Jews is not a conflict that is ongoing for thousands of years. It's about 100 years old. It started when the Jews in Russia and parts of Europe began experiencing severe forms of anti-Semitism and persecution, and eventually the Holocaust in World War II. The Jews sought refuge in and a long-term solution and began fighting for an independent state. And that fighting for an independent state wasn't fighting where they lived. It was going back to biblical roots and saying it's time that we amass a fund and start moving our Jewish brothers and sisters out of these areas of extreme anti-Semitism and found our own state. And Jerusalem was the natural place, or the Holy Land. The global powers had a hand in shaping the modern Middle East. Britain maintained power in the Middle East as a global empire after taking over from the Ottoman Empire after World War I. The French, the British, and the Americans divided the region into spheres, each controlling a certain part. America got and sought and successfully was able to get oil concessions from Saudi Arabia, while the French and the British divided up the rest and made promises to both sides. And the promises were unique promises. They could both have a national home for their own people. And the problem was that the promises were conflicting. Some were secret, some were open, and the maps were also in conflict. So there were pro-American regimes were primarily interested in oil because the United States was more interested in making sure that the Soviet Union, this is after World War II, we get through the World War I, World War II period, making sure that the Soviet Union never really got control of the world's oil supplies. And one of the things we did to make sure that we had everybody on our side is we went to the Middle East and we started to work on pro-American regimes against the Soviet Union after World War II. And we made a bargain. And this is the first bargain I want to talk about. The bargain was be anti-commie and let oil flow and we will protect you against everything. We will protect you against any Soviets. We will protect you against radicals, leftists, communists. Whatever you do, don't worry, we'll protect you. But you have to keep your bargain. Be anti-communist and keep oil flowing. And they said to Israel, as long as you're not radical, don't go the socialist direction and stay pro-American, we will protect you and let you grow as well. One part of that bargain that's driving Osama bin Laden today is you don't even have to reform your governments. You don't even have to go towards democracy. You don't have to open up your governments. You don't have to open up your free markets. You don't even have to open up your universities to a decent curriculum. And as a result of that bargain, from the 1940s to today, the whole of the Arab world is so far behind the rest of the world in every measurable statistic you can muster. From number of college graduates. In Saudi Arabia today, 60% of graduates are religion majors. Could you imagine all these seminary teachers? Yeah. Can you imagine a nation of seminary teachers? I was talking to a fellow the other day that told me, and the PhDs, masters and PhDs, are a higher number of religion professors. There's not a decent university in the whole of the Arab world, and some are struggling. Even American University of Cairo or American University of Beirut, weak curriculum. You don't have research institutions. There's just in the last 3 years, the very first Institute of American Studies was established in Amman, Jordan. I think Bonner worked out there for a short time. They've just begun to study America in the Arab world. There are 12 major Middle East institutions that offer PhDs in this country. We've been studying Islam and the Middle East now for 100 years in this country. And in the Middle East, there's not one Western university teaching democracy. Capitalism, as we know it, is non-existent. These are professional traders, but they're all monopolies and crony capitalism. There is no reform. You ship something from here to there, you have to bribe your way through customs. There is no procedure. You want a position in the government, you have to do it by family. You want to buy and sell and import and export, take Syria, for example. It's one of the most laughable countries in the world. There's still no private checking. I was there 2.5 years ago, and I saw my first cell phone in Syria. You cross the border to Lebanon, and they have everything. These countries are so behind that it will take them 20, 30 years to reach to where we were 50 years ago. The bargain stuck. They stayed pro-American and did no reform. The conflict between the Jews and the Arabs really has its roots in one statement issued in Britain by Lord Balfour. And this is before the battles really started. And I've forgotten the date. Who has the date on the Balfour Declaration? 1917. Before the Paris Peace Talks in 1919. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of that objective, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status of Jews in any other country. And that became the document that said, we are the global empire, so intense, go back to why do you refer to Palestinians as the non-existing Jewish population? Why don't you refer to them as Arabs or Palestinians? And there was this idea that once you gave them a label or a title, they belonged to a geography. And the battle began over semantics there. So we get talking about who's entitled to what and where, and that's where the things get really interesting. I was in Gaza recently. I watched a Jewish settler, and settlement is a very polite term for land theft. Settlements are from my personal perspective, an international criminal conspiracy on the part of Israeli-Palestinian land. It's nothing more elegant than that. They go take land, the Israeli government sends in the army, puts up the flag, puts the patrols in, puts the military in, and the land is gone and becomes part of Israel. The United States has acquiesced to that now for 30 years, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian acres and homes have just been stolen, turned into Israel. Hundreds of thousands. And we're talking now about what do we do about settlements. Settlements will never last in an international court. They can never last in polite company. It is the most racist criminal policy I've ever seen in my life. But here we are in polite company, and we call it settlements. Let me give you an example of it. I was in Gaza, and I was listening to a Brooklyn-born American Jewish woman saying that Gaza belongs to us. Gaza is the most godforsaken refugee camp on the face of the earth. It's 19 miles long, 5 miles wide. It's the most densely populated patch of earth in the world, more so than Hong Kong. All refugees, all poverty. It is the seething seedbed of Hamas and Islamic radicals. And she said, we're going to occupy this and transfer is the other polite word for ethnic cleansing. We're going to transfer all the Palestinians out. Well, what gives you the right to this land? Jonah was swallowed by a whale, and when the whale spat him up, Jonah, he landed on the beaches of Gaza. That makes it sacred territory, and that gives us a biblical obligation to reclaim it. And from there, you get to kill people and take over their land. Go across the street and talk to a Muslim and say, how about the country of Israel? What do we do about the country of Israel? Well, we've got to wipe it off the face of the earth. Well, what do you do with all those little kids and the women and all the Israelis? That's their problem. We just get rid of them. This is the Islamists talking. You absolutely wipe the Israelis off the face of the earth. Now, how do you bring those two people together? You arrest them and throw them in jail. That's the negotiating. There is no middle ground. And they're not the majority. They're less than 30% on both sides. There is no negotiating with them. You just need to build jails, and you put them away, and then you just go to the next person. And there are plenty of people. My guess is we're talking 60 to 70% of Israelis and Palestinians would reach an agreement if you allowed them. Let me take you through just a quick history, and then you'll want to ask some questions. I know that you'll be disappointed. I'm going to spare you the history of the British Empire. I know you'll be disappointed, but I'll show you a really thick, dusty book you can read. Creating a Jewish state was a problem of how do you reconcile the suffering of the Jews with the rights of the Arabs. And up to the Holocaust, you couldn't. And so they started sending Jews from all over the Eastern Europe, mostly Russia and other places, and wealthy Jews throughout the world started contributing to a fund to buy land and create labor farms and collectives all over Palestine. And they were buying land from absentee landlords. Legitimate land transfer was going on. And they bought a lot of land. And by the 20s and 30s, we started getting a significant increase in the number of Jews going to Palestine and buying and turning the land into fairly profitable farms. They were doing dairy. They were doing a whole series of fairly sophisticated farming. Between 1922 and about 35, there were 650 to 750,000 people in Palestine. 78% of them were Arab Muslims, 11% of them were Jews, and 10% of them were Christians. Nearly all of the Arabs were born in Palestine. Nearly two-thirds of the Jews were immigrants who had gone to Palestine from Europe. Between 21 and 1939, immigration of Jews persecuted in Europe became a flood of immigrants, and they began to threaten the Palestinian claim to the land. By 1939, the Jews made up 31% of the population. That is from 17% in 31 to 31% in 39. So in a short 8-year period, they doubled, nearly doubled. At the time, the Jews were building institutions exclusively for their own sake. For example, all of the factories and all of the farms were for their own consumption. The Palestinians were under the British Empire. They were retarded in every way and form of development. They didn't have their own government, and they didn't have any of their outside support. When World War II came, the close of two major influences changed the political landscape of the Middle East. The Holocaust and the British Empire and its decline, exhaustion, and collapse. After 25 years, the British could no longer sustain themselves in the Middle East. November 1947, the UN voted in a resolution, 181, to divide Palestine into a Jewish and a Palestinian state. On May 15th of 1948, Israel was created. The UN gave them 57% of the land, while only 33% of the population. But the Palestinians were given the rest and had 60% of the population. When Israel declared itself a state in 1948, neighboring Arab states invaded and tried to repel them and failed. The UN engaged in a ceasefire, and the first negotiator, Count Folke Bernadotte, who was head of the Swedish Red Cross, went in and tried to negotiate and was assassinated. Now comes the roots of today's problems. And approximately 900,000 by Palestinian count and 600,000 to 700,000 by Israeli count were driven out of Palestine. 150,000 stayed in Palestine that became Israel, and the rest became refugees in surrounding states. The 500,000 to 600,000 or 700,000 or 800,000, no matter what the number you want to take, fled to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. 150,000 stayed in Israel. The 150,000 are up to 1.5 million, going on 2 million in Israel. And they call it the H-bomb, the human factor, the human bomb, because they're outproducing the Israelis. And within 20 years, there will be more Palestinians in Israel than Israeli Jews. The Palestinians who became refugees have turned into 3 to 4 million in all of these other countries, and they just have not assimilated. And here was the deal. The Israelis assumed, as I have a comic son in Los Angeles, and after taking him to the Middle East, he has a stand-up routine, and one of his jokes is, my dad took me home to the homeland, and after I went through Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, they all looked alike. They all looked like Mexicans. Anyway... they do look alike, and the Israelis had always assumed that the Palestinians would just move to Jordan and become Jordanian. They'd move to Lebanon and become Lebanese. They'd move to Syria and become Syrian, and the same with Egypt, and it didn't happen. They refused to assimilate. So today, those people are still together, and it wasn't until a young Palestinian engineer by the name of Yasser Arafat in 1964 gathered all the elite Palestinians of Kuwait, and he organized a political group called Fatah. And they represented the 750,000 refugees scattered around the world, and they went around essentially blackmailing as many of the oil-rich Arab countries as they could into paying dues to create an organization, because up till 1964, the collective Arab countries represented Palestinians. And it wasn't until 64 that they took on their own identity. And here's what kinds of stuff that they did. They went and got all the fundamental literature of the Israelis at the time and took all of the publications and began to distribute it to the world on what the real intention of the Israelis was all along. Here's a quote from an early Zionist leader. Zionism is the ideology of the Jewish people, which is to restore a homeland in the homeland. His name is Yosef Wentz. He wrote in December 20th of 1940, "Between ourselves, it must be clear that there is no room in the country for both people, Arab, Palestinian, and Jews. We shall not achieve our goal of being an independent people with the Arabs in this small country. The only solution after the end of World War II is a land of Israel, at least a western land of Israel, that is Palestine, without Arabs. There is no room here for compromises. There is no way but to transfer the Arabs from here to the neighboring countries, to transfer all of them, save perhaps the Arabs of Bethlehem, Nazareth, and Old Jerusalem. Not one village must be left, not one tribe, and only after this transfer will the country be able to absorb millions of our brothers and Jewish, and the Jewish problem will cease to exist. There will be no other solution. Now, this is a small message. This is the major theme of what to do about the Arabs from the Arab literature. Go to the Arab side and what to do about the Jews. And the first solution that the Arabs had was rather unique. Why don't you give Germany to the Jews after the Holocaust? You hear that all day long. And if you sit down and you say to them, if you were a Jew, where would you most likely want to be? If you're a deeply religious Jew, somewhere near Jerusalem. My own feeling today is if I were a refugee of any type, I'd want to be in the United States, the freest country in the world where you could survive. I personally believe that the future of the Jewish people will be in the United States, because this is where most intellectuals and the successful people who have contributed so much to the development of America have come from, not from Israel. And I don't think that they will ever be comfortable living in Israel, because they can never really come to terms with the bargain that they made with themselves, and that is to destroy the Palestinian civilization and build their own nation on the destruction of the Palestinians. And they've got work to do on that. Let me just give you a little background on where we are today. In the last 72 hours, the President of the United States has issued what they call the roadmap to peace. It's fashioned after a term used by King Abdullah of Jordan, in which he was in the White House last year, and he turned to Bush and he said, we're in a fog, we're in a dust storm, we really don't know how to get out of this mess, we need a roadmap out of here. Bush turned to Cheney and said, he's looking for a roadmap. And then they went into talks about what would a roadmap mean. Well, and they were very simple. Show us how to get out of this circle that we just keep following our tails around. And they go back to the negotiations of the Clinton administration. And one of the biggest problems we've got is that the Bush administration has said, anything Clinton did, we want to do the opposite. And anything he didn't do, we want to be doing. And if you look at all the talks, they have abandoned the talks, and about 2,000 Palestinians and about 800 Israelis have died during the Bush administration. All of these are innocent civilians, most of them innocent civilians, dying at the hands of suicide bombers or Israeli-targeted assassinations or bombings or collateral damage. And the administration has turned a blind eye to all of this. Now they've issued the roadmap, and they put together a list of ambiguous goals that are going to be extraordinarily difficult to achieve, and the president promised that he would achieve peace between the Arabs and Israelis over the next 3 years, given a whole set of circumstances. All you have to do is go into the internet, it's on there as of yesterday, and they will tell you what the roadmap is about. The problem now is that this president has never solved any major problem without the military. We've never really seen him engage in anything but the military. On North Korea, he's just begrudgingly going to the negotiations, but threatening to blow up. On Iraq, he didn't even consider negotiations, didn't consider UN inspectors. Not that I'm sad to see Saddam Hussein gone, but when I think about the costs of negotiating and getting the UN in there to knock him out, and I think about the destruction of Iraq, would it have been possible? Would it? We don't know. It doesn't matter now. Saddam Hussein is gone. The real test of what we did in Iraq will come in the next decade on how we see the historical fallout. Seeing Saddam Hussein gone, I don't see one negative coming from that. But how we rebuild Iraq is where the real story is going to be told. Not the victory. This is the world's most powerful country, decimating a fourth world, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth rate power. The Utah National Guard could have won the war. I don't I don't mean to denigrate our military. My own brother got activated to fight that. Yes, sir.
I was in the Utah National Guard. That's not true.
No, really, Robert. How long you been out? Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'm told actually that the Utah National Guard was actually among some of the first troops in Baghdad.
They were. They are. My brother is there. He's been activated for a year. You saw how quickly that fell. It's part of a superior military, but it's a very weak country. Very weak country. Let me end this, and then let's start some questions. What can I say to you as Latter-day Saints that would help you focus on a position? For example, you may not be comfortable taking a position that blames one side or the other, but let's take just one quick little peek at what the brethren have said about it. A conference years ago in which he talked, it's called All Are Alike Unto God. It's in the Ensign, June 79. And here's what he talks about. As members of the church, the Lord's church, we need to lift our vision beyond personal prejudices. We need to discover the supreme truth that indeed our Father is no respecter of persons. Sometimes we unduly offend brothers and sisters of other nations by assigning exclusiveness of one nationality of people over another. Let me cite as an example of exclusiveness the present problem in the Middle East, the conflict between the Arabs and the Jews. We do not need to apologize nor mitigate any of the prophecies concerning the Holy Land. We believe them and declare them to be true, but this does not give us the justification to dogmatically pronounce that others of our Father's children are not children of promise. We have members of the church in the Muslim world. They are wonderful saints, good members of the church. They live in Iran, Egypt, not in Iran anymore. This is before the Ayatollahs took over. Egypt, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and other countries. Sometimes they are offended by members of the church who give the impression that we favor only the aims of the Jews. The church has an interest in all of Abraham's... And by the way, my patriarchal blessing doesn't put me in any of the little puny little tribes that most of you guys are in. I'm a direct descendant of Abraham. So, you children. If you'd like to discuss this after, I'd be willing to take some time to counsel you on your inferior status. We should remember that the history of the Arab goes back to Abraham through his son Ishmael. Imagine a father with many sons, each having different temperaments, aptitudes, and spiritual traits. Does he love one son less than another? Perhaps the son who is least spiritual inclined has his father's attention, prayers, pleadings more than others? Does that mean he loves the others less? Do you imagine our Heavenly Father loving one nationality of his offspring more exclusively than others? As members of the church, we need to be reminded of Nephi's challenging question, "Know ye not that there are more nations than one?" At the present time, we're engaged in the project of beautifying the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem by the garden. This is 1972, as I mentioned. The Orson Hyde Garden, an early apostle of the church. It is not because we favor one people over another. Jerusalem is sacred to the Jews, but is also sacred to the Arabs. Both the Jews and the Arabs are children of our Father. They are both children of promise, and as a church, we do not take sides. We have love for and interest in each. The purpose of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to bring about love, unity, and brotherhood of the highest order. Like Nephi of old, we should be able to say, I have charity for the Jews, and I also have charity for the Gentiles. And then he goes on and he says, to our friends of Judah, we say, we are your brethren of the house of Joseph. We feel a close relationship to you. We are messengers of the true covenant and hear a message that God has spoken in this day and time. To our kinsmen of Abraham, we say, we are your brethren. We look upon no nation or nationality as second-class citizens. We invite all men to investigate our message and to receive our fellowship. Now, let me just close by saying one of the big problems that we do have in the church is that we tend to be pro-Israeli, but in a very anti-Semitic way. One of the great promises that we've made to ourselves is that we're going to favor the Jews because we need to get to them and baptize them and save them. And then eventually we'll get to the Arabs and we'll save them. But we're not going to accept them in their current state, because their current state is inferior. like the fundamentalist Christians that are supporting Bush right now, that are opposed to the peace process. There is no one more opposed to peace in the Middle East than the fundamentalist Christians of America and people like Orrin Hatch in this country. I mean, they encourage the Israelis not to go along with the peace process. Behind the scenes, they encourage Netanyahu not to listen to Clinton and not to sign any peace agreements. And so you find these warmongers among the deepest religiously motivated Christians of this country. And they're a dangerous group of people. But when you get right down to it, they're deeply anti-Semitic. Because I'm a Palestinian, when I go to the Hill and do voluntary lobbying with our Arab American organizations, you wouldn't believe the things they'll tell you because you're a Palestinian and they believe that you want to hear it. They will begin with those damn Jews every time. And they will start talking in the most anti-Semitic fashion, thinking, oh, this is just exactly what I want to hear. And when you sit down and you say, why do you say that? And they'll go back to biblical times, and eventually some of those congressmen and senators will talk about how the Jews crucified Christ. And I'm telling you that some of the most primitive, vile anti-Semitism I've ever heard is on Capitol Hill, and a lot of them in the church, and a lot of them in the religion department at BYU. And I find that a lot of these people aren't pro-Israeli at all. They're anti-Semitic pro-Israelis in the sense that what they want to do is get credit, like a statistic, of being able to bag the whole Jewish country and convert them. We've got a lot of work to do in our own communities of bringing people around. But we as Mormons have not been peacemakers. We ought to start turning our hearts and our minds to the empirical data that's bringing Arabs and Jews together, because the Gentiles are bringing them together in negotiations. And the liberal Jews of this country are bringing the Jewish community to the peace process in this country. And they don't have allies. Right now, the biggest enemy to the liberal Jewish community that's trying to bring peace to this country are the fundamentalist Christians and some of our own brothers and sisters in the Mormon Church. I have always believed that there would be peace between the Arabs and the Jews, if there'd be a Palestinian state. I don't believe that Arabs and Jews will kiss and make up soon, but I think they'll learn to work together. I've worked enough out there on projects. I've seen it. I put projects together myself with Arabs, Jews, Christians, Muslims. And that just in the last 3 years, they work well together, and they can work well together. And there is exhaustion from so much blood being shed for nothing, for no good reason. I would urge each of you to take a really broad look, because as most Mormons, I think, falsely believe, you really don't need to worry about bringing people together in the end, because the millennium will come and it'll all be over. Let me just give you a piece of advice. Stay on your diet and pay off your debts. The end is not near. Your kids and your grandchildren will fight the same battles that you're going to be fighting. And if you want to give up, you know, take a day off, but, you know, get back to it. Every problem we face in the Middle East has a solution. It won't be easy, and it can be done. Thank you. Let's take 15 minutes if we've got some questions. Dennis, go ahead.
I'd like your opinion on what the Israeli settlers, if you will, are doing in Israel is different than what the European settlers did in North America vis-a-vis the Native Americans. And the same apartheid that's happening now in Israel happened in America 300 years ago.
Yeah, that's your answer. 200-300 years ago. It was a less civilized time. We have higher standards now. I think human nature progresses, human society and civilization progresses. There's more against the law now than any other time in history in different countries. We have higher standards. We have moved the human condition to higher ground, higher expectations. We have mechanisms, international, domestic, against those kinds of activities. I think that's why the horrors of Africa and the bloodshed between the Hutus and the Tutsis and all those kinds of activities are so horrifying to us now. We don't accept it. We do have higher standards. Yes, sir.
You have an interesting view of the liberal Jewish community in the United States. You make them sound monolithic, like they all agree. And my sense is that they don't all agree. That is, some of them really do see a promised land. Some of them are sending substantial amounts of money to Israel. Some of them are electing congresspersons and senators who are in turn sending even more money to Israel. And how do you break that change?
Well, there isn't a monolithic Jewish community, but there is a very substantial body of liberal Jewish, not just intellectuals, but political activists who have signed on to, say, the Oslo Agreement and the others. That's not. It's a very influential large group. They've been rather silent. They're not as active as, say, the Christian fundamentalist and the religiously motivated Jewish groups that have been more active. And they've got lots of dollars flowing. Five, 6 days ago in the Post, the 1,000 people that signed that, scholars and businessmen from the Jewish community. We're talking hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions. They're not alone. You've been contributing. To date, the United States taxpayers have given Israel from 1948 to 2002 $236 billion in aid and tax incentives. Turkey's gotten about $170 billion. Egypt's gotten about $130 billion. Jordan's gotten about $25 billion. Palestinians have gotten about $1 billion. So we're all invested in it. The battle is on, but I don't see a clear winner on this one. I think that the fight is still on and winnable. Mike?
The Israelis expect the United States to be an honest broker. The Palestinians, I think, hope that the United States will be an honest broker. With the prospect of Bush's re-election, I think being a very strong prospect, but whether that, in fact, occurs or not, do you think that Bush and his administration can be an honest broker?
I think we're past the honest broker. The president is deeply religious. Wears his religion on his sleeve. He's completely committed to the state of Israel as the fundamentalist Christian in this country are. I think that there's not a big difference between Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and the president's attitudes on Israel as religion comes. But he's not a very complicated guy in some ways, and he has said, I'm going to solve this problem. Does he have the political will? We don't know. It's going to be a test, but it'll only take about 3 to 6 months to find out if he has the political will. If he doesn't have the political will, the fallout will be catastrophic to U.S. foreign policy, because he has made a promise to the Saudis, to Blair, to Britain, and all the others, that he will broker this. There are hints, and you look at them and you say, well, how did he introduce the roadmap? He sent a memo and then got on a plane and flew off. He didn't announce it. He sent the ambassador to Israel, Daniel Kurtzer, to hand deliver it to Sharon when all the Europeans went to Palestine, all the prime ministers and foreign ministers, and delivered it and made a big show of it. So the biggest test that I think that the Bush presidency will have will be in the next 90 to 180 days. To us, the courage, the backbone to do it. And, you know, knocking off Iraq will be a picnic compared to what he's headed, and I don't know where he's headed now. And the prospect of him getting reelected automatically is, I think, is a long shot. We haven't even begun on George Bush. He has no opponent. He has good numbers. But the way the economy's going and everything else, I just happened to see John Kerry deliver a speech here a couple of weeks ago, and he was very impressive. Very, very impressive guy. And I don't know if, you know, John Kerry is Jewish. He's raised Irish Catholic, but he's Jewish. His grandparents converted their name from Cohen to Kerry many years ago. Jews are not going to be afraid of John Kerry's attitudes on it. And we had a chance to talk to him, and Nancy, you didn't grab him by the lapels, did you, Nancy? She shook and grabbed him by the lapels and said, what are you going to do about Palestine? And he said, it's no secret what has to happen. It's just going to take guts. We all know what the outcome is. We know what the end game is. Everybody knows what the end game is. It's already written and done. It's just a matter of implementing it. And his wife is worth $900 million. So I don't... I think that Bush will be in trouble when they zero in on him.
What kind of difficulty do you see, or how do you respond, I guess, to the argument to talk about intellectual cousins of the Islamicists being in the White House and influencing Bush and everything else? More so than an anti-Semitic pro-Islam, is there anything worrisome in that a lot of these people see this as fulfillment of a prophecy, they're speeding the day of the final battle and the second coming and bring it on, and how frightening is that? How do you lobby against that?
Well, if you take those two, one on the faith and commitment, and it's almost an ideology, not just a fervent faith, but an ideology, and you put the national interest on the other side and say, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict is a speed bump on the way to the bigger problem of working with the Islamicists and the Muslims who can help us defeat this Osama bin Laden movement. I think when you weigh those two, these deeply fervent fundamentalist Christians in this country who are trying to drive foreign policy, they pale in significance to the consequences of ignoring this, because it's a small problem compared to where we're going.
President's ear on the one hand, and he agrees with them. And I was reading Pat Buchanan's article, The American Conservative.
Whose war?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a fascinating confluence of events seen in one way. How do you get out of that?
I think that there are enough realists in the Bush administration on policy that they want to transform the whole of the Middle East. If you take Wolfowitz and the neocons in the administration, they know that they cannot get to where they want to be and leave the Arab-Israeli conflict unsolved and a Palestinian state unfulfilled. They'll never get the Iraq they want. They'll never transform Syria into a modern country. They'll keep the Wahhabis fueled in Saudi Arabia, and they'll keep the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt. I tell you, what we're facing in the Arab world and in the Islamic world is just, I think it's double the threat of communism to this country, what we're facing. We're talking about a billion Muslims, talking about 68% of the world's oil. If we don't address this problem forcefully and begin to invest in it with serious consequences, we're going to allow what I consider to be nearly an insignificant minority in Israel to destroy America's national interests. I think those are realistic issues that the Wolfowitz and the people in the White House, Cheney and the others who are deeply committed to these religious types, know that they have to face. If you look at their rhetoric and you look at what they've written, this administration has done nothing less than written a blueprint for transforming the whole of the Middle East into a secular democratic region. That would be a lot like saying, I'm going to convert Utah County into a Catholic enclave. You know, it's just that difficult, and they know what the consequences are. 9/11 will be a frequent occurrence if we don't defeat the Islamicists. That's why I think what we face is far more important than these frivolous religious notions that the Christian fundamentalists are promoting. David. I think we're going to be in Iraq 5, 10, 15 years. Your point on the United Nations is well taken. We're in a new era now. The United Nations will not work for the future like it's worked in the past. In a bipolar world where you've got the Russians and the Americans fighting and trying to gain allies, you needed an arena, you needed a stage, you needed a forum where you could sit down and argue it and run your resolutions. But in a unipolar world where we really dominate, we dominate in such a massive way. I don't know anything about the military, but I was looking at the numbers. Nobody's even near us on any of the numbers. Airplanes, battleships, missiles, technology. The United Nations probably needs to turn into a very, very aggressive Red Cross. I see a transformation in which the United Nations will have to redefine who they are to be useful, and we're not going to need them much more, and we can thank the French for that. The French have shown us that there is no middle ground on some things, and the French have become probably I mean, more derision aimed at the French out of this White House than the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think it's a terrible mistake. We should be building bridges, but we've got a whole new pattern of who our friends are. And the pattern is looking like this. Anybody we can bribe, anybody who needs a friend, and what we call anybody that we can hire. And if you look at this coalition that we just went into the Iraq war, they called it the coalition of the billing, not the coalition of the willing. We don't need anyone else. Here's the question that I always ask all of the classes that I teach now. If you are by the most powerful country in the world, how should you govern yourself? Let's imagine you're a boxer or you're a football team and you're running up the score. Should you stop scoring? If you hit the guy a lucky punch and he's reeling, this isn't a very good metaphor for women, but do you yell to the guy, back off, let him get his energy and hit you? You know, we are so powerful, we've got to redefine who we are in the world today. We got more college graduates, more PhDs, more bachelor's degrees, more doctors, more lawyers, more engineers, more inventions, more patents, more Nobel Prizes, more technology, more adapted to public use than any other society in the world, more cash flowing through our economy. What do you do with all that strength?
Mandatory Peace Corps.
Great image, except that the U.S. is not monolithic.
You mean internally?
Internally. All the engineers, but look at them. You know, there's a good proportion that are Indian.
I realize we've got, what is it, 60 to 80,000 MDs in this country from India? They're American citizens, though.
So that analogy for me is...
But they're staying. They're staying.
They're staying. So their children will look more like the run of the mill.
But the issue isn't so much where they're coming from and who's contributing. Why do they come? Because there isn't as much opportunity abroad. The question isn't whether we're all monolithic or not, but the question is, how should we behave as an international power? What do we owe? And the debate is raging inside of the White House in all the major theories of international relations. The realists of going out and while you're ahead, make sure you stay ahead. The idealists inside the White House, the pals, saying, while we're ahead, let's go out and make as many friends as we can and build international institutions and spread the word. Then there's a group of internationalists led by Wolfowitz who's saying, let's remake the world in our image. Let's go out there and let's really kick up a storm and remake the world. Iraq should be first. Why Iraq? It has the best soil. It has the best supply of oil, second only to Saudi Arabia, about 160 billion barrels of oil reserves. It has soil, water, and an intellectual capacity. 24 million people with a very secular society that is very advanced compared to the other Arab countries. And of all the countries we could take over, it's not like Afghanistan. You can get them on their feet and develop them. That's the theory. I'm not so sure it's going to be that easy. So the Wolfowitz crowd, which are the internationalists and the neocon movement, are saying it's time to go out and build a world in our own image while we can. How do you argue with that? It's not going to be as easy. We're going to engage ourselves, end up with another Vietnam where we can't pull it off. What? We are in an era that we've only experienced one other time in the history of America. Right after World War II, we had a monopoly on the atomic bomb. And everybody at the time, and there's a whole body of literature that says now's the time to bomb Beijing and Moscow. And they had a knockdown, drag-out battles in the Pentagon and the State Department that they don't have the bomb, we have the bomb, we've got the nuclear monopoly, we have got the power and the military to knock out anybody anywhere near us. And we didn't do anything. And instead, what did we do? Truman went to the United Nations and said, we're willing to give you our bomb and turn it into peaceful use. And everybody thought that was the fatal mistake that led to the Cold War. And for the next 50 years, we ended up with China and Russia in an arms race. Here we are again, another opportunity to lead the world into a direction and have not one other country or groups of countries that have the power to stop us. What do we do with that power monopoly, that economic monopoly, and that will? It is a great opportunity to destroy the world, rebuild it, bring an end to hunger, Now, here's the thing about this president that makes him unpredictable. He just allocated $15 billion to fighting AIDS. It's inconsistent with his conservative pattern. He just doubled and tripled the amount of money that's going into education for children and Head Start Bureau. It's inconsistent with the conservative credentials. He just, for the first time in the history, moved the budget of the Department of Health and Human Services above the Defense Department, $516 billion next year. Never seen that before. So we've got somebody that is not very pretty to be isolationist, and then he went off to do Iraq, and that's unpredictable. He looked like he was going to be a fiscal conservative, and he blew the budget to kingdom come. And he doubled and tripled the normal increases for the Defense Department, which was predictable. So where are we going as a country? These are the most fascinating times to be alive, because America is going to determine how the world turns out, and everybody's behind the eight ball on it. Everybody's reactionary. Every time somebody issues a paper out of the Pentagon or the State Department, we sit back and say, you can't do that. Why not? We've changed. We're a new country. And the national psyche isn't where it's supposed to be. We're in trouble in this country because it's a democracy and we don't know where our country's leading us. Let me tell you, if we don't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, there is going to be a lot of fallout in terms of the confidence of our citizens in our national government. We have to find weapons of mass destruction. I held a class recently of 200 teachers and asked them, why did we go to war in Iraq? I got 11 different answers, and out of the 200, I couldn't get any 15 people to agree on one. Why did we go to war in Iraq? Regime change, preemption, weapons of mass destruction, the oil, because we needed a demonstration project. A lot of people think it was the last. We needed a demonstration project. We needed to show that we are willing to act, and that we would, and we wouldn't be embarrassed to go out and do it. And we needed a lab. We needed a lab for our stealth bombers and some of our missiles and some of our new light, quick, less people. And people are serious about that. And they've just recently done some polls. And people actually believe. In Spain, 70% of the public polled yesterday, a poll released yesterday in Spain, 70% of the people think we did it for oil. We have a serious national problem. Well, let me thank you again, and just let me leave you with this last thought. As Mormons, as Americans, as thinking people, you've got several major hurdles as Americans that you need to overcome. And one is, what kind of America are we going to leave our kids? What if you could do things like invade Iraq, knock them off, and make all your children safe for the next 50 years? All you had to do is be a bully. What if you sat back and did nothing, and the next thing you know, you have an alliance of countries that can stop us from doing anything we want because we failed to act? And as Americans, what if we ignore the Arab-Israeli conflict and we fuel the Islamicists and we see another 9/11 and another and another? These people don't work in patterns. It takes them months, years to plan their catastrophic strikes against us. How do we deal with that? The actions that we take today, I think, will write the way we live for the next half century. And some people in this country, another term of George Bush, may lay the groundwork where we won't have as many options or choices as we'd like. So I think the thoughts that we need to ask ourselves is, what kind of a country do we want to leave our children? And we don't know. There's no consensus. That could be troubling, and that could also be very challenging in a very positive way. But you've got to have an awful lot of confidence in the leadership of the country to see it as a positive opportunity going forward. I, for one, am not that comfortable with the leadership of the country right now, because we're not getting clear signals. We're not getting clear signals on why we do what we do. And until we do and we get a consensus on it, I think we're going to end up with some serious problems going into the next election on what it is we're about. Thank you for inviting me to come.
Really don't need to be dismissed.
Reception right next door. Look forward to seeing you all tomorrow.
Good night. Thanks so much.